What a flashback that music brings. Now, we all know somebody who's obsessed with sneakers. You might even be the sneakerhead. Sneakers have been part of fashion for decades, but now kicks seem to be taking over. Last year, couture fashion houses started selling sneakers with exaggerated looks for over $800. That's almost as much as the average American earns in a week. But how did we get here? For this week's Please Explain, we're talking about all things sneakers. Author Nicholas Smith has a new book out titled Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. In it, Nicholas charts the history of American product innovation as seen through the sneaker sport culture. He looks at how sports and sneakers often developed in lockstep with each other and how sneakers were one of the first products to use celebrity endorsements. It seems the culture of celebrity, sports, and sneakers are inherently intertwined. The book came out on May 1st, and Nicholas Smith is here today. Welcome, Nicholas.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Now, there are a lot of people who are so interested in this. Listeners, if you are an avid sneaker collector, a self-proclaimed sneakerhead, call in. Our number is 212-433-9692. Again, that's 212-433-9692. And you can tweet us at WNYC Midday or leave a comment on our show page about how you started collecting them and why. So, Nicholas, so many people are collecting sneakers these days. To understand the development of sneakers, you explained that it's essential to understand how rubber was popularized. Why rubber?
Yes, that's right. Well, in the early 1800s, the state of rubber was very dependent on the temperature. If it was too hot, the rubber melted, and if it was too cold, the rubber turned brittle. So you couldn't really have a sneaker with a rubber sole because if it was hot out that day, your shoe would literally melt into the pavement.
Ooh. So what happened in 1844 that changed things?
Well, an inventor named Charles Goodyear found the process to vulcanize rubber. Now, what it means to vulcanize rubber is to make that rubber stable so it could be hot outside and your rubber wouldn't melt, or it could be cold and it wouldn't turn brittle. So this opened the door for many, many different products, not just sneakers, of course.
So how did the Industrial Revolution make leisure time available to more people?
Well, it kind of freed up time for people to begin with. You didn't have to work for your sustenance as much. Now, how leisure time kind of began for the working classes was in industrial Britain. They had to close the factories to do maintenance on the machinery now and then, and the workers had a small break, and these were called Wakes Weeks.
Now, Wakes during weeks? This time.
Was Wakes it? Weeks. Yeah, Wakes Weeks.
Gotcha.
And during these couple weeks or so, they would take vacations often to a seaside resort town to relax and, to have a little break from work. So this kind of the concept of leisure time and even the weekend grew out of the Industrial Revolution.
So how did sports come out of this increased leisure time?
Well, sports were another way of common activity. Now, one of the big sports or games activities in the 1800s was croquet. And if you'll remember from Alice in Wonderland, the Red Queen played croquet. And when this book was written, this was kind of at the height of the croquet boom. So I'm sure if it was written maybe a couple years later, perhaps the Red Queen would have been playing tennis, which became popular shortly afterwards.
But she wasn't wearing sneakers.
She was not wearing sneakers, to the best of our knowledge.
So what about these walking matches? So people would actually walk, just do that?
Yeah, this was kind of one of the first big sports obsessions is people would walk for sometimes 6 days at a time, and this would be a big spectator sport to see just how fast and how far people could walk. And there's this, one famous story of this person who, to see Abraham Lincoln's inauguration in the middle of the 1600s, he said, okay, I'm going to walk from Boston all the way down to Washington, D.C., and people would, turn out to see this person go by. And after the next couple decades, people were packing Madison Square Garden to see these big walking matches, which nowadays seems kind of odd that this would be, something people would pay for.
You could just walk up and down 42nd Street and have a walking
exactly.
match. So before the sneaker, there must have been something else. What was the forerunner?
Well, the forerunner, no pun intended, was kind of a a track spike the way we would think of it, but it resembled the like an Oxford shoe with metal spikes driven into it. And this was, you know, how people would run on early dirt tracks. And again, this is another form of entertainment, is people would, you know, go to these inns or pubs and watch a running race. And of course, if you had shoes with spikes in them, you ran a bit faster.
But, were they comfortable?
No, they were not. This is also a time when there wasn't much padding in shoes, so you couldn't really, run 20 miles in these, very early running shoes.
Was that their major limitation?
That was one of the limitations. Another limitation is the shoe didn't offer much in the way of support. Leather can be either very stiff sometimes or very, very supple. So if you didn't have a shoe that fit very well, you obviously weren't going to give the best performance.
So what's the relationship to croquet and sneakers?
Well, one of the earliest, you can kind of call it a proto-sneaker, was the croquet shoe. Now, we don't really have so many of these shoes in existence, and it's probably not so much what we would think of and envision as sneakers nowadays. But the reason why people would wear different shoes on the croquet fields is so they wouldn't ruin the grass. Obviously, a shoe that did not have a very strong heel to it would not make punctures in the grass. So one of the earliest, examples of people changing shoes for sporting purposes was for sports like croquet and sports like tennis, is to more to preserve the playing field rather than to give a performance boost.
So I understand how you could call them tennis shoes, but where did the term sneakers come from?
So this came from kind of out of the ether of the 1800s. I believe it was a jailer that said, shoes with...
All right, let's go to a break.
We're going to take a brief break right now. And when we come back, we're going to learn all about more sneakers. And I'm speaking with Nicholas Smith for this week's Please Explain. His book is Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers. And we're going to listen to some callers because this is a top topic here in New York City. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back after a break. And we've been talking about sneakers right now. So, Nicholas, you're still with us. When did celebrity first get linked to sneakers?
Well, one of the earliest instances is a name we're all still familiar with, Chuck Taylor. Now, Chuck Taylor worked for a company called Converse, and he had been a professional basketball player in the 1920s. But when we say professional, by today's standards, it's more of a semi-professional nature. Now, after his playing days ended, which weren't very long, he went to work for Converse, which had been making basketball shoes at the time. And he went from town to town selling the shoes, but also conducting basketball clinics to high schools and colleges, anyone who wanted to show up. And what he did in this clinics, he kind of spread the gospel of basketball from town to town. So here are some of the best ways you can play. Here are some of the tricks for passing and shooting and these types of things. But of course, what he also did as a Converse salesman, he said, "Well, the best way to play basketball is in Converse shoes."
Oh, now we have someone on the phone from Weston, Connecticut, who has a question for you. Anne, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, how is everybody doing?
We're good. What's your question, Ann?
Just fine, thanks.
Well, I have a son that's 23, and he has over 200 pairs of sneakers.
Wow.
Starting with Michael Jordan's that he got when he was 8 years old, and he's constantly buying and selling them. How profitable really are these sneakers? I mean, he's selling some of them, some are skate sneakers, some are basketball. I mean, are we really talking some of them are actually worth what sometimes he's like, oh, some of these shoes are $2,000 that you see some of the stars wearing. John Mayer has always got some crazy Nikes on, and my son will say, these are $2,000 or $3,000. Is that really true?
Okay. So I want you to answer that question, Nick, but first I want to also bring another caller in who has another question. He actually wrote in a question about Air Jordans. Do we know about the cost and appreciation of these things? How much did Jordan sneakers influence sneaker collections?
Okay, well, I'll take the first question first, and then I'll get to Jordan's influence. It's absolutely true that some shoes increase so much in value, but of course, this is the kind of black magic of trying to predict any sort of price increase, whether it's sneakers or stocks, is trying to get the one that will go up the most correct. Mm-hmm. In my book, I talk about a shoe called the Nike Pigeon Dunk. It's a gray and orange shoe with a pigeon stitched on it. And it was a limited edition collaboration in 2005. It retailed for $200. It now sells online for $8,500. So if you happen to have a limited edition shoe that lots of people want, it can go up quite a bit in value.
Wow. So one of the revelations in your book is how Adidas and Puma came to be. Who were the creators of these brands?
The creators of those brands were the Dassler brothers, Adolf and Rudolf Dassler. They were two brothers who lived in southern Germany, and in the 1920s, they started their own shoe company. Now, in the 1920s, there weren't so much in the line of sports shoes, so they principally made shoes for running track and soccer shoes. Now, they had some success earlier on, thanks to the 1936 Olympics, which was hosted in Berlin. But what made the Dasslers famous today is they had a falling out. Mm. Their shoe company they founded together didn't last through the war, and they each decided to found their own shoe company. But neither one wanted to leave their small town in Bavaria, so one set up shop on one side of the town's river, the other on the other side, and to this day, this is where the headquarters of Adidas on one side and Puma on the other are. And their animosity was so strong that this town is called nicknamed the town of bent necks, because people would look down and see what shoes you were wearing to kind of flesh out, are you siding more with Adidas or more with Puma? And the brothers never really reconciled, and they're buried on opposite sides of the town cemetery.
Wow, what a fascinating story. But meanwhile, there are a lot of people who are just continue to collect these sneakers. Did you come across many in your research?
Oh, yeah, of course. And what I found was, sneaker collecting is, like any sort of collecting. I grew up collecting baseball cards. And, there is a certain magic of finding that card that, you've been waiting for. And for, people collecting sneakers, there's, those one or two shoes out there that they really want, that they just can't wait to get their hands on. So there, the reason for, collecting sneakers is kind of the reason for collecting anything. I mean, it means something special to us.
We have a caller from Harlem who has been collecting sneakers since the 1960s. Peter.
Wow.
Hello.
Hey there, Peter.
Yeah, hey. I just want to say that your story about Chuck Taylor is interesting, because when we were kids, we used to say, if your feet slip and slide, get the ones with the star on the side. Those were Converse, by the way. And another thing is, as in most things in America, especially in New York, it was black kids that made sneakers legendary. You forget to mention Pro Keds and Spalding, which later also had status. See, back in the 60s, we used to go to dances, and we used to have our suits made, our pants made, and we would wear the sneaker as an accessory to our shoes. We would wear alligator shoes. It was always black kids that made it happen. But today, I have a question for you, sir. Why is the quality of the sneaker so poor? Even though these kids are spending a fortune, a lot of it isn't even real leather. Comment, I'll hang up.
Thank you very much, Peter. So, question about the quality, Nicholas. Is it going down?
I think it's tough to say. I mean, I certainly have shoes that have lasted quite a long time, and I also have shoes that have, not lasted much longer than a year. So I think it really depends on the make and the model and, what conditions you buy your shoes in. But, that's a very interesting point that, sneakers are not really a product that's made to last in many cases. So if you are lucky enough to have a shoe that, lasts longer than, a couple years, by all means, hang on to it.
Let's talk about the business of sneakers, and with in particular focus on marketing. Were consumers originally the target market for that? Were commercials geared towards regular people, or was there a middleman in this process?
They weren't quite geared towards regular people just yet. Now, in the earlier days, the way you marketed sneakers to children was you marketed to the parents. So you wanted to highlight the sneakers' durability and how long it lasts and these types of things. And it wasn't really until later on, especially in the Jordan era, where, you found that talking directly to the consumer, paid off quite handsomely.
I can walk down the street now and go to a store that specializes in sneakers, but it wasn't always that way.
No. I mean, it's almost in the grand scheme of things, a new thing that we would have shops specifically for sneakers, but not just, for sneakers that you would use for basketball or running, for sneakers that you would wear primarily as a fashion item. A long time ago, you bought your shoes in a sporting goods store that also sold, baseball gloves and bats and basketballs and other things. But, nowadays it's, perfectly normal to go into a store that only sells sneakers.
During the first half of the 20th century, was it hard to buy sneakers?
It was not as easy as it is today. Very few companies, compared to nowadays, made sneakers. As one of the callers said earlier, there were, there were Converse, there were PF Flyers, there were, a very limited number of brands. And as there are a limited number of brands, you're not going to find them everywhere. And, then sneakers were mainly used for athletic activity or for gym class. Now, we wear them going to the grocery store.
Your book really shines a light on some of the lesser known characters in the sneaker business and the sneaker world. Who was Bill Bowerman?
Well, Bill Bowerman is most famous for being one of the co-founders of Nike. Phil Knight, of course, the other one. But Bill Bowerman was a track coach for the University of Oregon in the 50s and 60s. And like any track coach, he wanted the best for his athletes. He would do, anything to get their times faster. Unlike other track coaches, he experimented with different running surfaces. He wanted his athletes to wear the lightest possible uniforms, and he even went so far as to make his own running shoes for his runners. Now, some of these homemade concoctions weren't even meant to last longer than two races. They would fall apart, sometimes even mid-race. But what Bowerman learned in making shoes for his runners is that a lot of the shoes that were available at the time weren't really suited for running or jogging.
Peter from Harlem was talking about collecting sneakers since the 60s and about the unique relationship that New York City has with sneaker culture. What role did New York's amateur basketball culture play in popularizing the Puma Clyde?
Well, anytime there's a great crowd around and everyone is focused on especially the players on the court, you want to see what they're wearing, and you want to kind of emulate that. Now, the Puma Clyde was a shoe that came out in the early 1970s, named after Walt Frazier Clyde, the great New York Knick. And the more players playing in basketball courts on playgrounds wore the sneaker and adapted it, the more popular it became to other people who were watching and other people who wanted to play basketball like the local celebrities that they wanted to emulate, Walt Frazier Clyde.
So he was the first NBA player to have his own signature shoe. Was that the first instance where there was this crossover from the court to fashion?
Yeah, that's right. Now, the shoe, of course, is still made today, and it's not really suitable for, you know, playing basketball in, and, you know...
Because it's too fashionable now?
It's too fashionable now. It's too expensive, and, you know, really, the technology in basketball shoes these days is just, you know, far surpassed it. But it was one of the shoes that transitioned from the court to the street, and people started wearing them because... they were available in nice colors. They looked good, and it's kind of a maybe the reason why we wear Jordans and we revere Michael Jordan shoes is there's that connection to someone. There's that connection to Walt Frazier.
If you're listening and you want to join the conversation, our number here is 212-433-9692. Today's Please Explain is all about sneakers. You can also tweet us at WNYC Midday. So you mentioned about this crossover, Nicholas. Adidas' Stan Smiths. Is that another example of this crossover?
Yeah, definitely. And, there's this, Stan Smith was a tennis player who was number one ranked at the peak of his career in the 1970s. And Adidas created this all-white shoe with perforated dots that kind of formed the famous Adidas three stripes along the side. And, you know, this shoe is still worn today. I even see teenagers wear it. And I wonder if they realize that Stan Smith is an actual person, maybe the same way that we wonder that, Chuck Taylor was an actual person and not something concocted by marketers. But, this is another example of a signature shoe becoming almost, more famous than the athlete that wore it.
Earlier, you were telling me about the advent of more leisure time. But in the past couple of decades, I noticed that Americans are increasingly a little bit more athletic, even though they're not pro athletes. Did that shift correspond with the general popularity of sneakers? Is there a link?
There is a link. The earliest instance of this is the jogging boom of the 1970s and 80s, and this is where people kind of took more of an interest in exercise as a leisure pastime. And, as more people bought jogging shoes, they realized, hey, these are comfortable. I'm going to wear them, wherever I go. After the jogging boom, there was the aerobics and fitness boom, and the shoes that came with that also made the transition from athletic activity to fashionable items. So, we're constantly living in a world of athleisure where, the comfortable shoes are, inspired by sports, even if they're not necessarily used for those sports anymore.
You remember Vans. How did they get that tagline, off the wall?
Well, off the wall came from skateboarders. Now, Vans didn't begin as a skateboarding brand. It was adapted by skateboarders because of its customizability. You can come in to an early Vans shop with any sort of fabric that you wanted, and they would make a shoe for you. But Vans shoes were also very, very durable. So when skateboarding was transitioning to vertical skateboarding, where people would shoot up the walls of empty pools and do tricks and land, this was very brutal on the shoes. So if a shoe fell apart, it wasn't going to be very good for you. But Vans shoes were a lot more durable in handling this. So the off the wall tagline comes from skaters going off the wall of the side of an empty pool.
My memory of Vans comes from that movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High. How did that film popularize the sneakers?
Well, in that film, Sean Penn's character, Jeff Spicoli, he wears these checkerboard Vans slip-on shoes. And at the time the movie came out, Vans was more centric in California. So, when the rest of the country saw these very unique, very different looking shoes than the shoes available at the time, it caused Vans to explode in popularity very, very quickly. And, I think, a lot of people, at the time bought that shoe specifically because of its connection with the movie.
They wanted to live that life. Was this the first example of product placement in films?
This wasn't the first example, but this was probably one of the most common examples of a product doing so well for the company that their popularity increased very, very quickly. Nowadays we can't even watch a film without a product being featured in it, and it's hardly blink anymore if a character is wearing Nikes per se.
Nicholas, could you explain to me how the term sneaker came to be?
Well, sneaker, as you can imagine, comes from sneak. So, in 1873, there was a jailer who was quoted as saying, "Sneaks are shoes with canvas tops and india rubber soles." Now, you can, walk around almost noiselessly in shoes that had rubber soles, and they eventually, took the name sneaker. So this is why, we call them what they are.
Because they make so little noise, the sneakers. We have a caller from Manhattan. Steve, do you have a huge sneaker collection?
Yes, hi. I'm aware of the fact that during the New York City transit strike that lasted more than a week, women for the first time started wearing sneakers, especially over the Brooklyn Bridge, long walks to the financial district and throughout Midtown. And that was the advent of allowing workers in the office setting to begin wearing shoes to work for the first time, as I recall.
Do you wear sneakers to work?
No, I don't.
pity for you. So, Nicholas, are there more examples of this where people started wearing sneakers to work after these social moments like strikes?
Oh, of course. I mean, it's kind of an outgrowth of, casual Friday. It's you couldn't go to an office and not see sneakers. But I'm glad the caller brought up this story about the transit strike and how many people were wearing comfortable shoes going to the office. It did create a slight bump in sneaker sales in New York City stores as people were rushing out to buy shoes that were more comfortable for walking in. But there was a scene in the 1988 movie Working Girl that kind of speaks to this. And for people that don't remember the movie, Melanie Griffith's character at the very beginning is riding the Staten Island Ferry to work, and she's wearing a pair of Reebok fitness sneakers. And then when she gets to work, she changes back into her high-heeled shoes. And this is kind of indicative of where sneakers were about to head. They were about to head inside the office because they were comfortable to wear. They got you to the door, and soon they were going to get you in the office.
Mm-hmm. If we could switch to Air Jordans, oh, one of my favorite sneakers. What role did Spike Lee play in popularizing them?
Spike Lee didn't come on board until the third iteration of the Air Jordan, the Air Jordan 3. Now, around this time, they were looking to kind of reinvigorate the Jordan brand. So they hired a very young director, Spike Lee, to direct a series of commercials starring himself as his character, Morris Blackman, from his first movie, and Michael Jordan. Now, these were black and white commercials, kind of in a funny man, straight man dynamic. So Michael Jordan would play the straight man, and Spike Lee's character would play kind of the nutty goofball. And one of the famous lines from this commercial is Spike Lee is trying to get Jordan to say, what makes you so great? Is it your jersey, your shorts? Is it your shoes? And then it's got to be the shoes, Michael. It's got to be the shoes. And this "it's got to be the shoes" line taps into something a lot older than the commercials, whether they were conscious of it or not. What makes Cinderella a princess? It's the glass slipper. What makes Dorothy come back from Oz? It's the ruby slippers. So this idea of a shoe that has power, that gives you something a little bit more, I think this is what really made that campaign sing.
Fascinating. So we actually have a clip from one of the commercials he made.
Do you know who the best player in the game is? Me, Morris Blackman. And I'm way above the rim, demonstrating some serious hang time. Very serious. Do you know how I get up for my game? Do you know? That's right. Air Jordan. Mike, what's up? Oh, money. Why you want to do that to me? Why you leave me hanging?
Was it risky for Nike to brand this sneaker with a person's name rather than with their own branding?
Oh, of course. And it, you know, was also risky for Nike in the second version of the Jordan shoe not to have their famous swoosh on there. You know, they were relying purely on the star power of the very, very young Jordan in his early seasons. But wow, as we see now, it's paid off. And, you know, the Jordan brand is kind of a spin-off of Nike. It's still part of Nike, of course.
If but, you could briefly, you know, people can... I hate to interrupt you. If you could briefly explain, how do that tagline, just do it, come...
That came from actually an inmate that had been convicted for murder. He was about to be executed, and his last words were something along the lines of, you know, let's do this.
Oh, my
and
goodness.
And when it came time, I know, when it came time to, you know, think up a Nike slogan many years
wow.
later, this, you know, popped into the mind of the marketer.
Thank you.
You know, just
now, I'm speaking with Nicholas Smith for this week's Please Explain. His book is Kicks, The Great American Story of Sneakers.